give to hear those three little words? Man, that's such a wonderful
Patricia T. O'Connor is here, author of now four books, author or co-author of four books on the English language, Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and most recently, Woe Is I Junior for the kiddies, who really do need all the help they can get with the language. And Pat, it's always a pleasure to see you. And it's interesting that we just spoke to a British diplomat who thought very carefully about every word and the importance of every word. And now we're going to talk about American English vis-a-vis British English.
Mm-hmm. I found myself listening to his speech, picking out the typical British pronunciations.
They say laboratory.
Uh-huh. That's
why would they
that's
do something
one of the
so
characteristics.
Silly?
Well, there's an explanation for that. Words that end in O-R-Y, such as satisfactory, extraordinary, laboratory. Military, secretary, words like that. Typically, the British used to pronounce all the syllables in those words. And sometime during the 19th century, they started dropping syllables in that kind of word that had a penultimate stressed syllable. They started dropping that syllable. So they now say things like secretary, military, extraordinary, while we Americans keep pronouncing all four. But that's a typical Britishism.
So it's interesting that at a time when America was becoming conscious of creating its own version mm-hmm. of the English language with Noah Webster, mm-hmm. the British were actually changing the English language.
That's true. They were doing things like dropping the pronounced R, or pronouncing R as if it were a vowel. Now, at the time of the Revolutionary War and for a while afterwards, people on both sides of the Atlantic pronounced the R in words like far, world, mother, those sorts of words. And toward the end of the 18th century and early 19th century, they started dropping their R's and saying things like world instead of world and fa instead of far.
Well, we do some of that in some parts of this country.
Right.
Typically, we have the Rockefeller approach.
True. Typically, upper-class Easterners in the United States who still had a lot of contact commercially and socially with the British tended to adopt some of the changes they were introducing into their speech.
So you're saying we didn't change.
We didn't change.
We're speaking. Actually, it's probably best to perform Shakespeare with mm-hmm. an American accent.
True. We speak more the way Shakespeare did than the British do now.
Although less eloquently. I have yet to meet a person who spoke as eloquently as Shakespeare.
Well, in conversation, he may have been a schlub. We don't know. Maybe when he had a chance to write it out and think about it. But no, there are a lot of things that we kept doing that the British stopped doing. For instance, pronouncing herb, as we do. You know, it originally was spelled E-R-B-E. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare said herb. We say herb.
Julia Child didn't. Martha Stewart mm-hmm. says herb.
Right. I won't go ahead and finish what I was about to say, but Anglophiles like to give a British tone to their speech sometimes by emulating their speech. And they only introduced the H into herb in the early 19th century.
And then there are the words that are different.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
do have different words for things.
Right.
I was a student in England and had to Britishize mm-hmm. my speech. When I came back, very quickly, I stopped saying schedule, but I'd had to say schedule and other words,
right.
Pronounce them in the British way. Otherwise, people would not have understood me. But I remember my first day in art school, and I needed an eraser, and I asked the girl sitting next to me if she would lend me one, and she handed a razor blade to me, and I said, no, an eraser. And we had this momentary mm-hmm. dance, and then finally she understood. She said, oh, you want a rubber. And from then on, of course, I said rubber. But to me, rubber meant something very different.
Right. It meant galoshes.
It did.
Uh-huh.
And there were many things. Suspenders. Kids in this country wore suspenders with their trousers. Well, suspenders are garter belts in England.
Right.
And
you,
they say braces.
Right. Vocabulary is very different between the two countries. And a lot of the differences in vocabulary, of course, have to do with technical things that were developed after the colonies split off. So naturally, they would be different, like bonnet versus a hood of a car or a trunk versus a boot, those sorts of things.
Well, why do you think we, our studios, we're moving, but our studios have been on Center Street, C-E-N-T-R-E Street, ever since the station was created in 1923? Is it because Center Street predates the Revolution?
Well, Center is an interesting case because the endings of R's that or endings of words that end in an er sound, generally they had stabilized as a spelling at the ER spelling after about the 16th century. So those words, most of them were spelled ER when the colonists left England. A lot of French-influenced spellings were adopted in Britain during the late 18th and early 19th century,
theater
including R-E. So center, the R-E spelling was a fairly late development. And the ones, the Americans most likely to use the R-E spelling, again, were those who had more, had commercial contacts, say, with shipping or whatnot along the East Coast. But generally, the ER spelling is older for most of those words.
So I don't know how to explain that. We're on Centre Street, and some theaters are T-E-R, and some theaters are T-R-E.
Right. Those are sort of transposed now. I don't know if any Brits use the ER spelling for theater, but it's done both ways here now. I always think it looks a little bit anglified myself when I see it.
Well, I've always wondered why the British are inconsistent. They don't say enter, E-N-T-R-E.
Right.
There are all sorts of other words that could could use the French version.
Mm-hmm. For another example of a vocabulary difference that predates formation of the United States is that the British used to use both words fall and autumn for the season. And we imported both of them. And so we use both. But now the British have stopped using fall. They stopped using it quite a while ago, probably in the sometime in the 1800s. And now they think of fall as a Yankee eccentricity, a weirdness on our part and when it's really not. Another example is flat versus apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Apartment was a common British word for a suite of rooms used as a separate dwelling. Flat wasn't introduced until the 1820s or so. They stopped using apartment.
And
but
so now that's an American
they
vulgarism.
They think American, it's an American barbarism to say apartment instead of flat. And there are other examples, too.
Well, obviously, snobbery plays both ways, plays a role
play
in this.
It does play both ways, yes.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's area code 212-433-WNYC. Should we take some calls?
Yeah, thank you.
Tom from Merrick. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. How are you?
We are well.
I just had a quick question. Is incredulity, a couple of things, incredulity versus incredulousness and purple versus violet, are those anglicized or non-anglicized differences or are they just synonyms?
I don't know. I'd be guessing off the top of my head. You mean whether purple is the Anglo-Saxon and violet is the French?
Or whatever.
I don't know. I'd have to look those up. I can't tell you that.
How about incredulity and credulousness? Do you think that they're just synonyms, or are they? Is there a difference between those words?
Incredulousness and incredulity, they mean the same thing.
They
incredulousness
mean-
is a bit longer.
yeah, and it's harder to say.
Right.
I guess.
Incredulity is all that easy to say either.
No.
No, but it sounds more elegant almost. I thought incredulity was, like you said, almost anglicized And then I've also heard in England versus, and this is my last point, England versus here. Here we tend to say give to whoever needs it. The Greek is not usually subjective. But in Britain, I've heard, and maybe really it's correct, they say give to whomever needs it. Is it. Which one is correct?
Oh, well, to whomever, that's just an example of the objective case. That's. Did you say subjunctive?
But I think you meant the objective. But does that change when it says give to whomever needs it? In other
words, then right, then it's give to whoever needs it.
Okay,
there's no difference between British and American there.
Thank you so much for calling us.
By the way, I do notice that purple comes from Old English, from the Latin purpura, and violet is a French borrowing.
But the thing about English, and this is American English, British English, whatever, is we embrace all languages, and so we can say both purple and violet.
Right.
Although I think most people would feel more comfortable saying purple for that color that's a mix of blue and red.
I know, but it's odd. You'd never see an item of women's clothing in a catalog described as purple.
Yeah.
It would be called wisteria or dusty violet or something like that.
Well, I'm hysterical when I see those things. Joanne, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I found this fascinating conversation. My husband is British and I'm American, and we'd sort of gotten used to each other's language differences, but now we have a 16-month-old son.
And what are you doing? Are you splitting the difference when you teach the kid how to speak?
We're trying a bit to, so that we can sort of reflect his British heritage since he's, you know, we're living in the States now. But we've gotten into some big disagreements when we read him. Two things that I was curious about. When we read him ABC books, my husband insists on Z instead of Z. And I wonder where that comes from. If that's another change that they actually did instead of us, or... Who had it first, the Z or the Z?
I'm not sure about that. Let me just check that out. You know, I'm showing my age because I've researched Z before, and it's gone right out of my mind.
Well, it's the last thing that you want to think about.
The other thing we found, we just introduced our little boy to Ring Around the Rosie, and just at the climactic moment, right before you all fall down, I say, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. And the Brits say, tissue, tissue, we all fall down.
Tissue?
Really?
Yeah.
Americans should say Kleenex.
Do you think your husband is putting one over on you?
No, I really don't. I've done it with other Brits as well. Since
tissue.
It's true to say you never know with a Brit when it's all a practical joke. But no, my in-laws say it.
They can be taking the mickey.
Yeah.
You've heard that phrase?
I have.
I find that Zed comes from the late Latin. And it was adopted into Middle English from Old French, Z-E-D-E. So that's old, apparently. I guess that we say Z as a, who knows, maybe it's just a simplification. That may be one of Noah Webster's changes. I don't know.
Z is perfectly fine. Z is perfectly fine.
It is.
Let's call the whole thing off. Ralph. Hi, Ralph.
Hi there. Love this show. This is fantastic. My question is a very pressing issue. I'm wondering about aluminium.
Now, I think I don't know. I haven't looked this up, but I think aluminium was developed in Britain. And as I would understand it, aluminium should be the correct pronunciation, but we changed the pronunciation to aluminum.
Pronunciation, isn't it?
Yes, pronunciation.
I'm not sure which came first, but was this an element that was discovered before the Revolutionary War? Aluminum?
Not sure.
It may be one of those technical things that's just different here and there. I'm just checking. I know they spell it aluminium, and we spell it aluminum, and it's the exact same metal.
But they don't have Reynolds.
Reynolds wrap? I wonder what they call that. I'm looking up aluminium. Aluminum. Doesn't say when it was introduced or when it was discovered as an element, but aluminum is the American spelling, symbol AL. So aluminium is the British variant.
Variant?
It says variant.
I suspect one of our very knowledgeable listeners will be able to fill us in on this one.
I'm sure.
And we thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
We have to take a little break now. We'll be back with more calls to Patricia T. O'Connor and some of your comments. In fact, I got a really interesting one about tabling a motion. Maybe we can address that later. Pat O'Connor is the author of 4 books on the English language and visits us every month here on WNYC. I'll be also filling you in on some of the things. She's making a personal appearance soon. You'll be able to meet Pat on Wednesday the 28th, so we'll talk about that too. Stay with us. Welcome back to Patricia T. O'Connor, who's taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We're talking about Britishisms and Americanisms, among other things, although we are not limiting ourselves to that. We have a number of people who've called in about Americans who pronounce things in a kind of a British way. And here's Barry from New Jersey. Hi, Barry.
Hello. How are you?
We're okay.
Good. British speech in American movies of the 30s and 40s and maybe even the 50s, that's what I'm calling about. Seems to me as if particularly women characters in those movies, and particularly if they were supposed to be sophisticated, dropped their R's.
But they'd also say laughter, and they would sometimes they would roll their R's, wouldn't they?
What?
Sometimes they even roll their R's.
I don't
be particularly British.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was, but I'm wondering if people really spoke that way, or if it was just an affectation that moviegoers in the United States learned to accept as a code.
Or moviegoers accepted as a code from them and William F. Buckley Jr.
Okay.
No, they spoke that way. The British started dropping their R's in the late 18th century and early 19th. And actually, the poet Keats got a lot of flack from critics because he started in his poems making rhymes that were obvious he was dropping his R's. For instance, he would make a rhyme with thorns and fawns. Mm. So it was obvious that he meant the reader to read thorns and fawns. And critics jumped all over him for these kind of rhymes, saying he was corrupting the language, but that was the trend among upper-class British speakers at that time, and it caught on, and it became more or less universal.
Now, a lot of British actors played Southern roles for years mm-hmm. because it was felt that it was easier for them to make that transition. Do you mm-hmm. see links between the Southern
yes.
accent and a British accent?
Yes. For instance, the Virginia planters often they maintained ties with the mother country, and they a lot of the ways in which British speech evolved was imported into the South. So a lot of the southern drawl, it's an amalgamation of part British and part American.
And maybe that's why British folk music is still really so important to Southern folk music.
Oh, I didn't know it was.
Yeah,
oh.
People sing in Appalachia, sing songs that go back to 17th century England. Jane from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling to tell you that that American English can be quite different from British English. I'm a freelancer, and I specialize in Americanizing British books for the U.S. market.
Mm.
And it's not...
Is that a labor of love?
A labor?
That's what I'm calling about. It's not just removing the OU from color.
Mm-hmm.
It's syntax, it's grammar, the things are different. Mm-hmm. They might say that the couple are divorcing because the couple there is plural.
Mm-hmm.
Where we would say the couple is divorcing or the audience are clapping.
Right. They use different collective nouns, or they treat collective nouns differently than we do. They treat them as plural. They'll say GE are reporting higher earnings
exactly.
next month.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
On the other hand, they'll say the Mets is instead of the Mets are. We would say the Yankees are.
Uh-huh. And they'll say Manchester are leading.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And so I just wanted to say, and I'm not doing fiction, so I'm not removing, Harry Potter's jumper and switching it for his sweater. So
right.
I don't want to get anybody alarmed.
Right.
But there is more to it than most people would think.
So on a typical page, how many changes are you making?
On a typical page, say, I was just working on a book about animal life, and on a typical page, there would be, maybe 5 or 10 changes. They mm-hmm. do a lot of things like they leave out froms where we would put in a from, like, and the syntax is definitely different, and you're looking for bumps where people would say that doesn't sound quite right.
Mm-hmm.
They
use different verb endings sometimes too. For instance, we would say spoiled, and they would say spoilt, or we
yes.
would say burned. They might say burnt. And I should mention also that in many of those kinds of verb endings, the ed ending is actually the older,
right?
And they have.
So once again, we are the pure.
What
about
I don't
specialized?
Want to sound like that,
what about the Z at the end of our words?
Again,
S at the end of the British
right,
words.
Civilize, right. organize. Those are other. The spelling universally was I Z E at the time the colonists left England. It was only after the Revolutionary War that the I S E spellings were adopted in emulation of the French. The British went through they had a crush on everything French. In the late 18th, early 19th century, and adopted a lot of French spelling.
So, Jane, can't you just put the document through spell check and have it catch all of those things?
No, because it picks up the wrong things, because there are certain words, like, say, behavior, and then behavioral or behaviorize,
mm-hmm.
Are without the U in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Or glamour versus glamorize.
That's right.
Right.
You have to go through each, you have to read it for, and it's not just the individual words, it's how they're arranged in the sentence that can make them sound tricky.
Mm-hmm. And for instance, they might say, if you have a book and someone is asking for it, he might say, give it me. Rather than give it to me. Or here, give it him instead of give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
So they treat prepositions differently.
Can you
too.
Imagine Aretha singing, sock at me, sock at me, sock at me? Thank you so much for calling us, Jane.
Thank you.
And we have a caller, Richie from New York, who is going to clear up the whole matter of London Bridges falling down. Right?
Yeah. Hey, Brian. Hey, Patricia.
I'm Leonard, but it's okay. Brian is the British one.
I was doing so well. It's actually at issue, we all fall down. I forget what the American version was.
Ashes, ashes.
Right. The mm-hmm. nursery rhyme Ring of Roses is actually about the great plague that hit England in, I think, 1633, and sneezing was one of the symptoms of the plague.
Oh, so it's a-chew?
A-tissue. It's the sound of sneezing.
And a tissue is how you sneeze in Britain, huh? We sneeze by saying a-chew.
I don't know how that worked out. I don't know if it's a biology.
Well, do British still say a tissue when they're talking about sneezing?
Maybe they're asking for a tissue in anticipation of sneezing.
But it may very well be that's why we have tissues. That probably was some kind of a pun when they came
right.
up with Kleenex, came up with it.
Uh-huh, maybe. Maybe. How do you get a tissue of lies? How does that come about?
I came into this phone call so unprepared. I can't answer that question.
Well, it's nothing to sneeze at. So. Thank you for calling us. Maybe somebody else has the answer to the tissue of lies.
Could be.
I hear words that I think are mispronounced that turn out to be pronounced correctly. For mm-hmm. example, Carl Castle talks about the mercantile exchange.
Mm.
And it always sends off alarm bells. And then I looked it up, and sure enough, mercantile is the preferred pronunciation, not mercantile.
Well, you know what else is a preferred pronunciation until very recently? Niche. N-I-C-H-E. The only proper pronunciation used to be niche. In fact, my Webster's big second unabridged dictionary from the 50s has only niche as a pronunciation. Niche came along later in emulation of French.
Again, another French thing. Although it's interesting, when the British adopt French words, they tend to Britishize the pronunciation, and Americans don't. So we say garage, and the British say garage. The British say I forget how they pronounce ballet.
They say homage. They say homage, as the French do. We say homage, which is perfectly reasonable since homage has been in the English language since 1300s, with its first syllable stressed. The homage is only an emulation of the French pronunciation.
Before we go to more callers, let me read something from the comment line. This person writes, Peter from Red Bank, a favorite of mine is the near polar opposite meaning of the expression table emotion. In American usage, it means to suspend consideration of emotion. In British usage, it means to begin discussion of emotion.
I was just reading about that last week, actually. In one of Churchill's memoirs on the Second World War, he wrote about an incident in which there was a meeting of Allied leaders during World War II, and they sat down around the table, and the British wanted to raise a very urgent issue. And so they told the Americans they wished to table it, meaning to bring it to the table. But to the Americans, to table meant put something aside, put it away and forget about it.
So they said, why would you want to table it?
Right, so that the two sides had a long and he says, even acrimonious, actually Churchill's quote is, a long and even acrimonious argument ensued before both parties realized that they were agreed on the merits and wanted the same thing. And an interesting thing is that table used to have those dual meanings in English, and you just had to depend on the context to know. But in the 18th century, it could mean either one, either to lay it on the table or to defer it. But by the 19th century, after the colonies had split off, the Brits preserved one meaning and the Americans preserved the other. That's why we have this misunderstanding about it. Isn't that interesting?
It is.
I thought that was very interesting. But also, by the way,
it could lead to a war, you know. The War of 1812 was over tabling emotion.
Oh, was it?
No. But I think at one point in that conversation, somebody said, well, why would you want to table it? It expresses views we agree on. And the British said, that's precisely why we want to table it. Should we take another call?
Yes.
Our number here, 212-433-9692. And Fred from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. You mentioned Virginia having British pronunciation. Of course, Georgia does, too. And the most obvious place hasn't been mentioned, which is New England, and Boston in particular.
Right.
But nobody would in Britain would say, park the car.
Well, no, they'd say, park the car.
Right. So
because you're not pronouncing it properly. That's not the way Boston say it. You're giving a...
my mother was from Boston.
And I'm from Boston. But you're giving a kind of cliched version of how one would say park the car.
That's why I'm a talk show host and not an actor.
Exactly. But also, flat was used in the Boston area years ago. In fact, my mother referred to apartments as flats. So, and if, you know, it's obvious why. I mean, the British settled there, and the British influence is most pronounced in that region.
Did she take the lift up to the flat?
No. There weren't many lifts in those days to begin with, at least in the town I came from, and our elevators. But
well, it seems to me lift is perfectly sensible.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, sure.
Just like moving stairs is perfectly sensible.
Yeah.
I don't know why escalator is the preferable one here.
Right. And another thing, the fellow spoke about actresses using Britishisms, British accents, are actually New England accents. And New England has the same pronunciation, a similar, very similar pronunciation as Brits, but without the accent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, all over New England, it's a similar pronunciation with different accents. Maine doesn't sound like Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And when speaking of the actresses in 30s, 40s, 50s, of course, the most prominent one would be Katharine Hepburn.
Right. I was going to say mainline Philadelphia accents back in those days sounded very British.
Thank you so much for your call. Pam from Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Flat has come up again, but I wanted to ask about the origin of apartment. Is it because it's apart from the main dwelling? And also, I wonder if you have come up with any explanation for why the Brits take decisions and we make decisions.
Well, first of all, apartment, now I may be wrong, but I always thought this was an invention of the French when they started building apartments in Paris, and they were often huge house size apartments, but I think they gave them the name, didn't they, Pat?
It looks like it does. Right. French, appartement, from Italian, appartamento, from appartare, to separate. So, right, it is something apart, but it comes from, we get it from French by way of Italian.
Ah.
And ultimately Latin. But, yeah, it was used at one time commonly in Britain until it was abandoned for the flat.
And what about Pam's other question, take a meeting?
Take decision.
Take a decision? Do they really say take a decision?
Yes, you hear it all the time, like on the BBC or something. They don't make decisions, they take decisions.
Well, that's just, I have to say that sounds bizarre to me, because I've gotten mail from people who are curious about why some Americans say take a decision instead of make a decision, and I always tell them that they've gotten the idiom wrong. But to take a decision, I don't think that's the common American idiom. I'm surprised if it's the British one.
Thank you for calling us, Pam. Amy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, the British English is very different to American English.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the differences.
Saying to.
Different to, yes.
Yeah, rather than different from.
Mm-hmm. Or than, which some people disapprove of. But the example I'm thinking of is the use of the verb do, where mm-hmm. in American English we leave it out.
Right. They use it almost as an auxiliary verb, whereas I might say, have you read this book? And you might say, yes, I have done. Well, almost using do as an auxiliary verb.
Yeah, whereas in I almost said in English. In American English, we don't find it necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Can I add one?
Sure.
I've been hearing a lot on BBC programs, agree without any preposition after it. They agreed a truce.
Right, right. That's another British idiom. We always agree on something or to something, and they use it without a preposition.
Which always sounds strange to me, and it seems to be recent. Is that a recent change in British English?
I don't know how recent it is.
We should bring a British linguist in here sometime, because I'm sure that they have a very different perspective on this conversation.
I'm sure they would.
Although we're going to take one more call from Richard from Brooklyn, not from Britain. Hi, Richard.
Hey, Leonard. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm well. I'm good.
I am.
Take your choice.
I'm always sort of told off for using the word. I've lived here for 11 years. Come from London. I'm always told off for using the word obliged as opposed to obligated. I would say I was obliged to open the door for the lady,
mm-hmm.
and people here want me to say I was obligated.
Hmm.
And it rubs. Which is more correct?
I think to be obligated means that you were almost forced to, but to be obliged means that you're pleased to open the door. I think you're correct. Your usage sounds better to me.
That's more noblesse oblige.
Right. And also I was thinking of, in England, we say my apartment was burgled instead of burglarized.
Uh-huh.
Another one is normality as opposed to normalcy. Which has always seemed strange. I guess these are just differences, right? Neither one of them.
Who used normalcy? Was it Warren G. Harding? I think he used a return to normalcy, and people jumped all over him for using such a howling misusage.
It was an abnormalcy.
Right.
Well, thank you for calling us.
Thanks, Bennett.
And you should know that Pat will be speaking next Wednesday, the 28th, at the Mid-Manhattan branch of the New York Public Library. That's 40th Street and 5th Avenue, just down the street from the main library. You can join her at 6:30, where she'll speak about the myths and mysteries of English. And you can also go to her website, gramophobia.com, and click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. If you want to ask her a question, you can email her at mailbox@gramophobia.com. Have I covered everything?
I think so.
And I look forward to seeing you next month when you'll be back on the 18th.
Good. See
June
you then.
June 18th.
Okay. Bye.